The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this hour, you are going to learn to get the most out of your listening. We'll talk about how important listening is. We'll show you how to test your hearing at home or in the office, or test your boss's hearing, who's never listening to you, right? She certainly needs a hearing test. We can help you with that. Lots of great stuff this hour. Political listening we'll talk about. You can't miss it. But let's begin by listening carefully to this.
You know, they really are trying to stoke up this racial stuff.
Racial stuff? He's an African-American candidate, Ben Carson is, and he says racial stuff? Is he uncomfortable talking about this?
We're going to have to get beyond that. You know, I was asked by a reporter, why don't you talk about race very often? I said, it's because I'm a neurosurgeon.
Why would being a neurosurgeon make an African-American uninterested in addressing race in America, especially now? It's a question a lot of socially conservative African-Americans are asking about the Republican frontrunner. Ben Carson's success is a positive. His demeanor is a positive. Even being taken down by the media over his record is reminiscent of some other attempted takedowns of African-American politicians. But not addressing race, that could be a deal-breaker for Theodore R. Johnson III, a former White House fellow and military officer and doctoral candidate at Northeastern University. He describes himself as a Republican and says he's looking for what he calls a civil rights Republican. And he told us, as interesting as Ben Carson is, Theodore is still looking.
Ben Carson, his life story is folklore for a lot of African-American youth, especially in my generation in the 80s, 90s, growing up in middle school, high school age. And he's sort of the proverbial story of if you work hard, no matter your circumstances, you can achieve anything. That takes on special meaning for blacks because we have the added burden of being black in America. So that sort of presents some hurdles that others don't have to deal with. So it's not just about being American and working hard, but it's being black and American and working hard, and you can still have success. And he sort of represents that story that provides a lot of, you know, hope and optimism for young folks.
But particularly your generation saw him as a real role model, and he never really had to open his mouth much, but
That's right.
He definitely was a symbol of success, and he was absolutely at the top of his game. So he fit right into a, man, if he can do it, I can do it kind of narrative. Secondly,
absolutely,
he's conservative. He's a lot like Grandma and Grandpa, who may be all about the civil rights movement, but they also have some very conservative views on who you're going to date and what are you going to do with your life. And tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, and so I think his upbringing is very much like many blacks' upbringings when it comes to social conservatism. And I think that's really rooted in the Christian faith that's in the Deep South, and then much of the blacks that migrated from the Deep South to the Midwest, the Detroits, and then up as well as into New York and Northeast. They brought that Christian tradition with them. And that just is inherently imbued with these social conservative values. For blacks, though, social conservatism also meant, you know, like who you could date was based on race. That's not anything from the Bible. That's just sort of how it was interpreted for us. It's a sort of a contradiction when we are very liberal with civil rights, but very socially conservative. And social conservatism and Jim Crow meant that blacks don't have civil rights. So there is a little bit of some tension there between two things that propel much of the black culture, which is a belief in equality as well as it's the Christian tradition traditionally, historically.
Now, so, do you think there's a cleavage within the electorate in black America where if Ben Carson comes off as credible, his social conservatism is attractive to African Americans who might otherwise vote Democratic every single time?
I think so. But I don't think that social conservatism translates into votes for the socially conservative party. And that's because that conservatism is wrapped up with a whole bunch of other issues that don't necessarily benefit or interest all blacks, specifically around civil rights.
Are you saying civil rights trumps social conservatism?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Every day of the week. Absolutely. And so if the Republican Party had a more progressive civil rights platform, I really believe that you would see black people beginning to express politically some of their other interests. I mean, many blacks are social conservatives, many are fiscal conservatives, many are defense hawks and foreign policy interventionists. But that part of our political behavior isn't able to be expressed because it is trumped by, can I vote? You know, if you're the party that wants to disassemble the Voting Rights Act because it's no longer necessary and supports the implementation of voter identification laws that makes it disproportionately harder for black people to vote, then how I stand on where I stand on the Keystone Pipeline is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm,
know, what I think about what we should do in Syria doesn't matter.
Let's explore that for a second. A long time ago, and you were a youngster probably learning about maybe Ben Carson around this time, when Clarence Thomas was being confirmed,
right.
He was viewed as a conservative African-American who was sort of being played by the Bush administration and not necessarily credible among African-Americans until he played this card in a very dramatic moment during his confirmation hearing.
As a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you.
Now, Clarence Thomas was in a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing there. But the criticism that Ben Carson has suddenly received about his background, about things that he said, fair criticism, but nevertheless a certain kind of piling on, is that reminiscent of an expected idea that, all right, if you're Ben Carson and you're going to run for president, you have to expect that the white media is going to come after you and that that's going to attract a certain group of people who might be skeptical of that kind of criticism?
I don't know. I mean, we're in a very different time now. If we were talking about this Ben Carson story in the 80s, then perhaps. But we're talking about Ben Carson in the age of Obama, which it's a little bit different. I think a lot of the criticism Ben Carson has gotten is not because of his race. It's because of what he said. And if we look at how Obama was treated when he was running for office, there were a lot of racialized issues in his running. Jeremiah Wright was absolutely about race. Ben Carson, his criticism, these are the stories you've told about your rise from poverty into being the greatest pediatric neurosurgeon ever. Is it true? I mean, is your inspiring narrative verifiable? And if it's not, then we have to call into question who this person that we've constructed in our minds based on what you've said, is that person, is it real? Is he real? Does he exist?
But are you on the fence as far as Ben Carson is concerned? And do you think there are a lot of African-American voters like you that there is a speech he could give? He hasn't done it and he shows no signs of doing it. But is there a speech he could give that could answer a lot of questions and suddenly maybe pull you and social conservative blacks off the fence?
So I'm on the fence about who Ben Carson is.
Right.
I am not on the fence politically. I do not think he's ready to be president at all. There is not a speech he could give, and I can't think of anything he could do that would make me vote for him to be commander in chief. I think he missed his moment. I think when he was at the prayer breakfast with the president, I think that was a moment where he could have been 100% Republican, 100% black, and appealed to socially conservative whites and blacks in the way he sort of presented his argument about healthcare and the future of the country, et cetera. But I think what it turned out to be was an embarrassment. He tried to embarrass the president, and this isn't talked about a lot, but it's almost sacrilege to insult the first black president if you're black on a personal level. And a lot of his attacks against the president have not been about policy. It may start there, but it ultimately boils down to he's sort of insulting him at a personal level. I don't know that there's any black person, black politician that could expect to get black votes and call the president out of his name.
Interesting. So maybe what we've learned from the Ben Carson candidacy, though, is that perhaps there is a scenario out there, a pathway out there for a socially conservative African-American success story who is a little more articulate about the pyramids and, you know, a broad sense of knowing things about the world, who could articulate a civil rights narrative that would attract a large constituency within the African American community to vote Republican. That's conceivable now in a way that maybe wasn't so during the 2008 election.
Yes, absolutely. Well, without a doubt. And I don't know. I don't see that person on the bench yet. I have, you know, there may be one or two out there that could probably pull it off in a few years. But I absolutely believe that with the right messenger, the Republican Party could gain, you know, 20-30% of the black vote. And I don't believe that messenger has to be black. I believe that the right white social conservative Republican, and not even the social conservative part, the right white Republican with the right civil rights platform could win black votes, particularly if they're going up against a Democrat that the black Americans aren't all that enchanted with.
Do you see any one in the GOP field?
I don't. And so I tell you, in the current 16 field, I think John Kasich is probably as close as there is to a person that could appeal to black Democratic voters. Because Hillary Clinton has a lot of black support, but there are the margins there of folks that are not happy with the choice. And it's, you know, when you're following Obama, and it's hard to appeal to black voters following the president we've had the last 8 years. I think in this current field, Kasich is probably as close as it gets, and I just don't see him pulling it off.
It's interesting you mentioned Kasich, because coming right up, we're going to be talking with Christine Todd Whitman, former New Jersey governor, who's a big Kasich supporter. So we'll see what she has to say about some of the things you talked about, Theodore. Theodore R. Johnson III, former White House fellow and military officer, now a doctoral candidate at Northeastern University. Remember that name, folks. Ted, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Tonight's debate on the Fox Business Network will showcase the GOP field once again, and that makes our next guest a little nervous and a lot hopeful. Christine Todd Whitman served as governor of New Jersey from 1994 to 2001 and as EPA administrator under George W. Bush from 01 to 03. She's now president of the Whitman Strategy Group, and she thinks the GOP is missing a chance to own a whole lot of issues with voters, from race to climate change.
Well, I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed on a couple of levels, many levels, one of which is that you got to remember the environment is a Republican issue. The first land set aside for public use was under Abraham Lincoln and Yosemite, and it was, we know what Teddy Roosevelt did with mm-hmm. national parks. Of course, it was Richard Nixon who established the Environmental Protection Agency. So in the past, this has been a party, our party has been one that has embraced good, sensible environmental policy that has allowed the economy to grow while making lives healthier and better, the quality of life healthier and better for our citizens. And as for climate change, you can argue over how much of an impact human behavior is having. You've got to acknowledge that it's having an impact. You've got to acknowledge that the climate is changing. And right now, if in a heavy rain, Miami, the storm sewers back up and the streets flood right now because the sea level is rising. I mean, it's quantifiable. You can see it happening. Are we going to be all flooded out tomorrow? No, we're not. But it's happening. It's occurring. And what I would love to see is some forward thinking by our candidates, looking for the positive ways to embrace this and stop making every issue a partisan political issue.
By doing this, have GOP candidates just given an important issue to the Democrats?
Well, if you look at the polls where the average American is saying, you know, something's going on here and we want to see some steps taken. Better than 50% of the American people believe this. There are so many different ways to talk about how we address these issues in a positive way that right now we're polarizing everyone so much that you can't even begin to have the discussion of, is this an issue? Because we've assumed that the solutions are some of what the most extreme on the left would say they are, which, you know, close down everything, don't have another coal-fired power plant, you can't have any more gas, you don't want nuclear, heaven forbid. Well, we all know you're not right now going to be able to meet our energy needs solely with renewables. We may get there one day, but in the interim, we have to have a transitional power, and we'd want it as clean as possible.
We just had a really interesting discussion with Theodore Johnson, an African-American writer and political commentator who describes himself as a Republican, who says that there is an opportunity within the Republican Party to pull socially conservative African-Americans out of the Democratic column if there was a conscious and responsible discussion of race. He said that Ben Carson, in theory, could represent that, but has kind of failed him. He mentioned Kasich, yep, who's your candidate.
Right.
First of all, do you think that that divide exists in the African-American community and that a white candidate, as Theodore Johnson seemed to suggest, like Kasich, could take advantage of that, even though Kasich's poll numbers are pretty low right now?
Well, what's interesting is my first job down in Washington, well, my second job, I guess. First one was Office of Economic Opportunity, but the second one was running a program that I designed called the Listening Program, and it was to go out and to talk to groups of blacks, youth, and senior citizens about whether or not they were a part of a political party, whether they thought the political process could help them. And the more I listened to the black Americans talk, the more I said, you're Republicans. I mean, the kind of entrepreneurship, the what you want for families, that's what everybody wants. And we should be able to appeal to them. I don't get this idea that don't talk to the black population because they'll never vote for you. I certainly went out of my way to talk to them when I was running for governor.
Let's dig into that experience. You designed a program called the Listening Program.
Mm-hmm.
You listened to African-Americans and
right,
you heard them.
Right.
Did they hear you?
I wasn't trying to have them hear me. I was trying to listen and to tease out. And then who didn't hear me was the party, because I was working for the Republican National Committee at the time. And I went back to them and presented my findings and saying, we have a huge opportunity here. And I don't know. I've never seen the play Avenue Q, but I've heard the song over and over again. Mm-hmm. We're all a little bit racist. And the gist of it, from what I gather, is, look, we all have prejudices. And we'll look at somebody, and if they have pants down below their bottom, if they have long hair, or if we have all different ways that we judge people, we make snap decisions about them. If we recognize that in ourselves, then we can recognize, you know, that's wrong. We got to look a little bit further and we can get over it. But if you can't talk about it, you can't acknowledge it, or you're drawing these hard lines, it's pretty difficult to have the right conversation.
So listening is the kind of ventilation system for a party to keep it healthy and able to attract new voters.
I think so, especially listening to the non-traditional groups too, the ones you want. I mean, let's face it, women, better than 50% of the population. We are aging. We need to listen to the people. If you're about winning political elections, if you're about winning elections, then you want to – where is the biggest base? Unfortunately, right now, what we're seeing is we've so politicized every issue that the only people that are voting are the most extreme partisans.
So you should run.
My party wouldn't have me in the door.
Really?
No. I'm too far out there as far as they're concerned. I'm pro-life, and I do believe in – I mean pro-choice. Well, I'm pro-life because I believe in life. I'm not anti-life. I'm just pro-woman's right to make decisions on her own body. And I also believe that the climate is changing and that humans are having an impact on that. And there are things we can do that are very positive from an economic point of view that can help address those issues and still have us be a thriving economy as a nation.
Christine Todd Whitman, former governor of New Jersey from 1994 to 2001 and EPA administrator under President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2003. She's now president of the Whitman Strategy Group. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Listening, that's the key to better politics in the United States. We asked you, of all the folks you know, who do you wish you would have listened to more and why? Anoka, Minnesota, myself, which sounds really self-centered, but in hindsight, if I had worried more about what I thought instead of what other people wanted or expected, my life would have been far less troubled.
James from Lafayette, Indiana. My father. As a child, I just wanted him to be more of what I wanted him to be. As an adult, I began to understand how his past shaped him. He was a man of more wisdom than I thought, but didn't understand that until after he passed. Instead of glaring at his flaws, I should have gleaned from his experience.
Hi, my name is Joe. I'm calling from Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and I wish I had learned to listen to my parents. Being the last of three children, our relationship was tough, but they always guided me well, and I often regret the past decisions I made in spite of them.
We're listening. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like genetics, graphic design, and golf. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
The pro-democracy movement in Myanmar and the landmark election over the weekend for the five-year-old democracy of that country, it's another sign of broad and surprising change in Southeast Asia. The opposition party has claimed victory for Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, who said in a statement that now the winners have to be humble and the losers have to be calm. And now the test of all that. Tom Nagorski, Executive Vice President of the Asia Society, welcome. And Tom, what do we need to watch now to make sure that this trajectory is going to continue?
Well, I think, John, first, in the short term, you've got to see what and how the military responds, or if they respond. I think it's very early days. They haven't even announced the results. On the ground, people seem to think that's going to go okay, but they have the power with constitutional powers that they still have vested in the military to do certain things, to mess around if there's any kind of constitutional changes put forth by the opposition, the presumptive winners. I'm not of the school that thinks there's going to be anything like a backlash or crackdown. I don't think they're that foolish. So that's one thing. And then, you know, shorter, medium, long term really is how the NLD governs, because that is the world is littered with cases of euphoric moments like this one that in the longer term didn't go so well.
You've got in the region Thailand, which has its ups and downs constantly. And you also have for the prosperity of Singapore, not far away, and, of course, China. I'm wondering if this is it is glorious to be rich, kind of a Deng Xiaoping moment for the troika there in Myanmar, who kind of wishes that maybe there's a little more prosperity in the country, that it would benefit not only them but also the people.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little early days to be making pledges and claims like that. Certainly that's the hope. It's the hope both of people inside the country. It's also the hope of a lot of outsiders, a lot of companies who have been thinking. You mentioned it's a five-year-old democracy, but really there's been a lot of people who've been sitting on the fence in terms of whether to come into that country, both in terms of who's in charge, also how to get at some of the resources. It's a resource-rich place. Tourism is a big potential windfall for the country. But I think, first of all, you know, we got to get through this week. We have to see that, you know, that there isn't any of the nonsense and negative machinations that, again, I don't think are going to come. And then, you'll start to see whether those fence sitters, both the countries you mentioned, but also, outside Western corporations who are in there, by the way, already, many of them are, whether they put a bigger footprint on the place.
Does this fit a pattern of what's going on in the region right now? Taiwan, China, what's happening in the South China Sea, issues in Korea. Is this an outlier? You know, there seems to be a lot of change going on in the region.
You're right, and I think it may amplify the positives, assuming they are. And you can't lose sight of the enormity. I know it's very – I'm a former journalist, and at this moment we always look to what the problems are going to be. But I think it's worth, you know, lingering a little bit on – it's 50-plus years since they had an election that was both free, not rejected, and not violent. Mm-hmm. And that last point, by the way, which, you know, people skate over, that is a huge thing that people were very worried about. There haven't even been widespread claims of shenanigans at the ballot box. Mm-hmm. So it's an outlier in that sense. It's also an outlier. I don't know of a country on the planet in recent memory that is so vested in, for good, and maybe it gets a little complicated down the road, in one person.
Let's talk for a moment about, you've been there. How much rebuilding is going to have to take place?
Yeah, I have the odd distinction, I guess you could say, of having been there the first time as a reporter in all the way back in '89, and it was very beautiful, very pristine, draconian. It was, at that time, Suu Kyi was wandering around the country, really campaigning, not for office of any kind, but just against the regime. So on the one hand, you see extreme for somebody who hadn't been wide a spread of time, a lot of change. On the other hand, it doesn't look anything like its counterparts in the region. The changes that have been documented and reported in the last few years are very much infrastructure and roads have started to get better, especially around the capital. You see a lot of, you know, the cranes and the building and all that. It's not, I don't think, overrun. Traffic is bad, but they used not to have traffic lights that really operated, and they're there now. And the other thing is cell phones. I mean, it was... until fairly recently at your hotel, you had to do the old sort of, you know, book the call with a hotel operator kind of thing. So Cuba might be a bit of a comparison in that respect.
Interesting. Tom Nagorski, Executive Vice President of the Asia Society. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you.
Christine Todd Whitman said it. You've got to listen. So do you hear anything? How about now? 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 In the old days of hearing tests, with those big headphones the school nurse or the pediatrician would test your hearing with, make you listen to meaningless tones at different volumes. Listening is different than that, though. And Julian Treasure, a sonic expert and corporate consultant who delivered this celebrated TED Talk, says, we're not getting better at listening.
We are losing our listening. There are a lot of reasons for this. First of all, we invented ways of recording. First, writing, then audio recording, and now video recording as well. The premium on accurate and careful listening has simply disappeared. Secondly, the world is now so noisy, with this cacophony going on visually and auditorily, it's just hard to listen. It's tiring to listen.
The new podcast, Only Human, about how health shapes our lives, wants to get us out of those bubbles. Mary Harris is host and managing editor of Only Human, and she says that hearing loss and listening skills go together, and we humans rarely seek help or even suspect there's a problem.
There's really good evidence that 20% of people over the age of 12 have some kind of hearing loss that can affect their day-to-day communication, and almost none of them know about it, or they're too embarrassed to get it tested.
I wonder if it goes beyond embarrassment in the sense that the brain is kind of wired to work around stuff like this. So it involves hearing, but it also involves complicated psychological issues of, as you say, not wanting to let people know that you can't hear, but just developing communication strategies that just incorporate the hearing loss. And so it can be undetectable.
That's right. So we can get used to it. And some of the most interesting and intriguing research right now, I think, is going on at Johns Hopkins, where there's a researcher who's shown that these workarounds, when we ignore what's happening with our ears, it might have a real impact on our brains, because it's working our brains really hard when we have to fill in the gaps. So his research looks at Alzheimer's, and he shows an association between hearing loss and Alzheimer's. Now, it's really hard to tell where the chicken and the egg is with something like that. But his studies now are all about seeing if giving hearing aids to people earlier, when they really should be getting them, when they may not be getting them because they're too embarrassed, can stall the Alzheimer's a little bit.
It's a fascinating question.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it points up why hearing loss is really this interesting window on the brain, as well as this important attribute that we need to get along.
Well, yeah, it's our fastest sense. That was another thing that was
really
fascinating when we looked into this. So when we were evolving, you needed to be able to hear the snap of a twig if a predator was coming after you. And so your hearing never shuts off. Even when you're asleep, your brain is processing sound. There's a new set of researchers in Chicago who are actually looking at hearing as a window into the brain more generally. What they're doing is they're analyzing how we process sound from the youngest ages. They've found that it's linked up with all sorts of other things. So this researcher, Nina Kraus, who's at Northwestern, she can give a hearing test to three-year-olds. It's looking not at the ears, but at the brain.
Mm.
And what it shows is that she can predict dyslexia later. She can say, oh, you know, the hearing's a little bit off here. How we process sound is a little bit off. And I think that may lead to some reading problems. She's even found hearing differences in people who have autism. So it really is an overall measure of brain health, which is fascinating.
So we get tested for, you know, alarming things like breast cancer, prostate cancer. We get tested for eye, you know, our ability to see all the time. Hearing tests, not so much. Why?
Well, we do get tested when we're born. Every newborn in the United States is tested for hearing. But then we're not really tested again. They used to test kids in school.
One data point doesn't really help you so much, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're giving people a way to do that now.
Right.
We have this app we're partnering with, Mimi. You can go to onlyhuman.org/listenup. You can download it and you can take the test. It's really fun. I didn't know what to expect. Yeah.
I took it.
How old are your ears?
Well, let me just say that the test really tests you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like I remember in elementary school where, you know, it seemed sort of easy. What could this possibly show? Maybe my hearing was better. Who knows? But it's just the way that it does it in terms of duration and the visual interaction between what you hear and what you see is very well done. And you really do get a sense that your ears are getting actually tested. Because of that, I was terrified.
I was too.
To hit the key that said result.
Right.
But it turns out my ears are younger than my actual age.
My hearing age was 18. It was like the best news I got all day. Yep.
Don't try to put anything by you. We can't sneak up on Mary Harris.
Don't do it.
So that means now you're listening to music that 18-year-olds listen to, like Katy Perry.
A lot of Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift, yeah. There are different ways of losing your hearing, right?
Yeah, there are different ways. So the thing to know is that hearing loss isn't as bad as it used to be because there's all sorts of occupational protections now. It used to be that you were exposed to a lot more noise in your everyday life and it affected you. So that's the good news. The bad news is that we're all listening to music in our earbuds all the time and we're really not sure what that's doing to our hearing. And so taking a test like the MIMI test lets you sort of check in and see, where am I? You know, how are my ears? Are they measuring up?
What's the technology of hearing aids these days? You've got everything from headphones to cochlear implants in terms of the technology to restore hearing. What does that have to do with all of this?
Well, so what I think is really interesting, we interviewed a guy named Jay for this series who is deaf. And what he does is he uses his phone. He has an app on his phone, so he can just be walking down the street with this and talking to people, and they don't know that he has a hearing problem necessarily because he's able to use an app on his phone that amplifies the sound.
I see. Should our listeners, whether they can hear us well or not, should they be a part of this community on OnlyHuman?
They absolutely should. So onlyhuman.org/listenup. You can take the test and you can also stay tuned because next week, once you know your hearing age, we're going to be doing a whole project on listening. So even if you hear great, I'm sure you've been told, are you really listening to me? And we're going to give you a way to listen a little bit better.
Now, is the whole idea here, correct me if I'm wrong, so that you can listen better and be a more empathetic kind of person for your Thanksgiving dinner? Is that the idea here? Is that really the idea here?
It's kind of the Olympics of listening, isn't it? We talked to all these experts in listening, memory, and all of it comes down to you have to decide to pay attention. You have to remember to remember. You have to really invest. And it's a little bit about centering yourself before you go into conversation and making sure that you're there.
So a project of engaging one's heart with one's brain, with one's hearing, and the first step is to figure out how well, you can hear. That's what the folks at Only Human are doing. Mary, you don't look a day over 18.
At least my ears.
That's right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mary Harris is host and managing editor of Only Human, WNYC's podcast about how health shapes our lives. To keep up with their Listen Up project, subscribe to the Only Human podcast and find out your hearing age. Take the hearing test. It's easy. All you have to do is search for the iPhone app called MIMI. And hey, folks, listen better, won't you?
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Listen to this.
The most important stuff I've learned, I think I've learned from novels.
Do you hear and recognize that voice?
It has to do with empathy. It has to do with being comfortable with the notion that the world's complicated and full of grays, but there's still truth there to be found, and that you have to strive for that and work for that. And you know, the notion that that's possible to connect with somebody else, even though they're very different from you.
President Barack Obama looking for truth and listening for it in a surprising place. Maybe that's why his voice sounds so different here. He's in a room at the Iowa Public Library. It was last September when he sat down with one of his favorite writers, Marilynne Robinson. The New York Review of Books recently published a two-part podcast of this conversation between the commander-in-chief and one of his favorite writers. This week, I sat down with Marilynne Robinson to ask her about the experience of having the undivided attention of the commander-in-chief.
I'm pretty hard to dazzle. But his face is very communicative, you know, when you're simply talking to him. I know that when he has to do things in public, he takes on that role that anybody does, you know, of being the well-dressed man with the speech, you know. But when you're in conversation with him and perhaps things change from moment to moment in ways that he will not anticipate and so on, he's very readable.
What do you think your responsibility is as a voter, as a citizen of the United States, with this window, this audience that you had with the president? What does it do to you as a voter? What does it encourage you to be? Anything at all? It's quite a privilege. I'm wondering if there's a responsibility that comes with it.
I really feel a great deal of responsibility, and I would like very much to speak for him in a way that I consider exactly right. But there's a little asperity in my nature that he does not have, and that's, you know, that's where I err, I think, and have to correct myself. And this is me, this is not him. His terms have been so much dominated by these bizarre suspicions that are, you know, that are circulated in major outlets and so on. I've known since before he was elected that he belonged to the same denomination that I do, religious denomination, that is, because he and I spoke at the same convention, and he wanted to come to my church. And this is before I knew him or before anybody thought he was going to win anything. You know, the implication that he was not honest about what he said about himself was a slander, and it became as important, I think, as any actual fact during that eight-year period. I think that we found out that our democracy can be substantially undercut by slander, and that the media have to correct themselves, confront themselves, because, you know, I mean, he was elected president twice by good margins. You know, I mean, for me, I've always felt that I understood him in a very deeply because we do share the same theology. And to act as if it were somehow un-American or cryptic or furtive or something like that is just slander. There's no other word for it.
Is it possible that he is presiding over the beginning of the end of some epoch of white dominance in America, and that people's speech and their attitudes and their predisposition to slander is becoming a kind of Alamo moment for a group of people who will soon not be the majority?
You know, I don't know to what extent that's a real issue. I think a lot of things are said and done in this culture that factionalize it, you know? I mean, the assumption that groups are solid things with articulated senses of self-interest and so on, I don't know what that really describes. I think that, you know, this new evidence that there's a great deal of early mortality in middle-aged white people in this country, I think that probably correlates very strongly with things like the collapse of the labor unions, the collapse of industrial employment, the flatness of wages. I think that it's characteristic of people generally that in this country that they want to feel that they'll be able to help with their grandchild's tuition or whatever. And to undercut them, to make them not efficacious, I think is an extremely bitter blow to people. It would be to me. I'm, you know, granting I'm white and much more than middle-aged. But that's a terribly depressing situation to allow people to live in.
As a novelist with a real attention to detail and noting this presupposition that writers sometimes talk about, that, you know, their record button is always on. How do you rank him as a character that might show up in some fictional piece of yours down the line? Huh. Or someone like him?
I'd have to give that a lot of thought. He likes the character John Ames in the novel Gilead. I think that character endeared my writing and myself, perhaps, to him many years ago. And I think that the desire to be gracious that is characteristic of that figure, to not get in the trench warfare among people that have, you know, complaints against each other, but actually to step back and see the other person with a certain tenderness. I think that that's very characteristic of him, of Obama, that is. And, well, you know, in all candor, I admire him more than anyone I've ever known, precisely for that quality. And it would be hard for me to write him as a character.
You are just a fangirl.
Well, you know, it just feels good to admire somebody. I mean, just the sensation of respect which I have toward him, and which he enhances every time I have any dealings with him, it feels good. I'm enjoying it.
Marilynne Robinson, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Marilynne Robinson is an essayist and Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. Head over to thetakeaway.org for a link to her transcript of her conversation with the president, which was published in the New York Review of Books. last train? I don't think so. Here's something for you to take with you today. Listen to a many-layered Hall of Famer, the musical voice of New Orleans. Alan Toussaint died last night while on tour in Madrid, Spain, doing what he's been doing for decades, bringing the sounds of the streets and traditions of New Orleans to the world. He leaves us at the age of 77, but he might say all he's done is step out of one grand parade of jazz and funk and soul and stepped into another one, playing on that French Quarter Avenue headed straight up to heaven. Got a favorite Toussaint track? Tweet us your fave Toussaint track today at The Takeaway, and we'll share them. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.